Cold weather in January is not news, but the first half of this month saw record-breaking low temperatures. From the northern plains to Miami, the exceptional cold and icy conditions hurt truckers, orange growers, restaurant workers, and so many others. The second half of the month brought intense winter storms to the West Coast. But business owners don't have to take what Mother Nature dishes out anymore. Now they can turn to financial markets for help. Here to explain is Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax. Welcome back, Marilyn.
Good morning, Leanne.
All right, explain. How can financial markets help businesses cope with something as unpredictable as the weather?
Well, you know, in the financial world, people realize that business owners have to offset the economic impact of bad weather. So think about how important that is. The Commerce Department says one-third of all of our economic activity in this country has a direct link to the weather. We're talking about theme parks and utility companies, airlines. They all have this huge stake, and of course, farmers have the biggest stake of all. So all of these business owners are looking for ways to, and they're willing to spend money to find ways to offset their risks. And we used to do that just simply through insurance. When you think about Lloyd's of London, that was more than 300 years ago. They started helping merchants and ship owners to make sure that if your ship didn't come in, at least you didn't lose everything because you had insurance. So the securities traders, they thought about this insurance and they wanted to take it up a notch. They thought of something a little bit more sophisticated. And about 20 years ago, they created something called weather derivatives.
Weather derivatives. I mean, financial derivatives is a phrase we heard a lot during the market chaos in late 2008. But what's a weather derivative?
Well, these are futures contracts and options that allow the two parties to effectively bet on the weather. On the one side of a contract, there's someone who's willing to bet their money and hopefully profit if the weather is mild. And on the other side, there's somebody who is would gain if the weather turns out to be terrible.
Give us an example of how it would work.
Well, let's say you're running a theme park in Florida, and you know that you're going to lose a lot of money if it turns out to be exceptionally cold. So a theme park operator could hedge against really cold days in January by using a weather futures contract. Effectively, it works as a swap. There's one party that gets paid if a certain number of days are colder than a set point, let's say 40 degrees, and the other party gets paid if it turns out to be warmer than expected.
So does this mean businesses really don't have to worry about the weather?
Well, it means that business owners who are prudent and they hedge their risks with the help of these futures contracts, they can avoid the worst consequences of bad weather. But here's one other thing to ponder, that even the smartest financial wizards, the insurance experts, they really don't know how to create any instruments to hedge against global warming. If we really do have the worst of the predictions come true, with lots of coastal areas getting flooded and all sorts of huge storms, no one will be able to come up with a financial instrument big enough to protect against that kind of change. But I was looking at the jobs outlooks, and there is one thing that might be a safe bet. Private sector weather consultants seems to be an area of growth for jobs. So maybe the thing to do here is just to learn to be a meteorologist.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Leanne.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand. The words repeated multiple times by President Obama today, "I won't stop fighting." He was on a trip to Ohio to talk about jobs and the economy. His trip capped off a nightmare week for the White House and for Democrats. The loss of one Senate seat from Massachusetts has thrown the president's top priorities into disarray. In a moment, we'll dissect the damage with our regular political commentators. First, NPR's Don Gagne reports on the president's visit to the town of Elyria.
Northeast Ohio has seen steel and other manufacturing jobs disappear. And the president came here to answer those who say he's not done enough for working people in his first year in office.
If you ask the average person what was the Recovery Act, the stimulus package, they'd say the bank bailout. So let me just be clear here. The Recovery Act was cutting taxes for 95% of working families, 15 different tax cuts for working families, 7 different tax cuts for small businesses so they can start up and growing higher.
The president said he's not given up on overhauling health care. He cited his proposals this week to put tough new restrictions on banking practices and noted that he's accused of interfering with banks.
No, I just want to have some rules in place so that when these guys make dumb decisions, you don't end up having to foot the bill.
The president took questions from the audience. One came from a woman who owns a truck driving school that's hurting.
In the past few months, we've had a number of people on a daily basis coming into our school that's unemployed, but there are no training funds for truck driver training. And I want to know why that has changed.
The president said he couldn't specifically address her situation, though he said the stimulus package does contain retraining money. Then he used the moment to take on another common criticism of his administration.
You know, Obama's just trying to perpetrate big government. What big government exactly that we've been trying to perpetrate here? We're trying to fund those guys who want to go to truck driving school. We want to make sure that they've got some money to get trained for a job in the private sector.
The president always tells his audiences he enjoys getting out of Washington. This week, he seemed genuinely thrilled to get back to the scenes and themes of his campaign days. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand. People who closely watch the White House and its policies say something changed yesterday. President Obama proposed new rules to curb the growth of banks, and as NPR's John Itzde reports, that signals the reemergence of a legendary financial thinker as a major player in White House policy.
82-year-old Paul Volcker is a hard man to ignore. He's 6'7" tall, has a big voice, and is the closest thing to a superhero in the world of economics. As Federal Reserve Chairman back in the early 1980s, Volcker grabbed a dangerous inflation dragon by the throat and strangled it. But after naming Volcker the chairman of his Economic Recovery Advisory Board more than a year ago, President Obama seemed to have tuned him out for most of the past year. That is, until the president announced his new bank reforms yesterday.
I'm proposing a simple and common-sense reform, which we're calling the Volcker Rule, after this tall guy behind me. Banks will no longer be allowed to own, invest, or sponsor hedge funds, private equity funds, or...
Volcker had been advocating restrictions on risky bank behavior in speeches, interviews, and testimony for much of the past year, including in this appearance late in September before the House Financial Services Committee.
I would prohibit them from sponsoring and capitalizing hedge funds or private equity funds, and I would have particularly strict supervision enforced by capital and collateral requirements toward proprietary trading in securities and derivatives.
But the White House point person on regulatory reform, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, seemed to have a different view. During a September 10th visit to Capitol Hill, he said proprietary trading by banks wasn't a big factor in the recent financial crisis. Simon Johnson, a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, now at the Peterson Institute, believes Volcker's reemergence is significant.
This is a dramatic change in policy away from the Geithner approach, which has been followed over the past year, which is primarily being very nice to banks, towards the Volcker approach, which is being tough, but I think very fair and completely reasonable.
Some skeptics dismiss the administration's new proposal as politically calculated bank bashing. Indeed, it was announced as Goldman Sachs, a bank that received billions in government support, reported record profits and huge bonuses. And it came a day after a populist backlash in Massachusetts handed Ted Kennedy's Senate seat to a Republican. Nonetheless, Simon Johnson thinks the administration's move could shift the debate and reinvigorate a bogged-down financial reform effort in Congress. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. President Obama prepares for his State of the Union address this week after receiving a reminder of the limits of his power.
The speech comes 1 week after a special election in Massachusetts, where Democrats lost what had been thought of as a safe seat. They also lost an important vote for their side in the Senate.
Now the president hopes to recover, and one major issue he is expected to bring up is the gigantic federal budget deficit. That is a delicate matter, which we'll report on this morning. Many Americans want federal borrowing to go down, but it's hard to do that before the economy fully recovers, NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The federal deficit hit a record $1.4 trillion last year, and as the debts keep piling up, voters have been piling on. Never mind that deficits grow automatically during a recession, when tax revenues drop and unemployment payments soar. Democratic pollster Jeff Guerin says for many voters, the deficit has become a kind of shorthand for what they see as government spending run amok.
They see the tote board spinning and wonder where is all the money coming from, and particularly worry about whether it's going to be coming from them.
A survey by the anti-deficit Peter G. Peterson Foundation found 4 out of 5 voters now believe controlling the deficit and the federal debt should be a high priority for the president and Congress. That popular concern has amplified the warnings regularly sounded by fiscal watchdogs like former Texas Congressman Charlie Stenholm.
As you build your credit card deficit, ultimately you have to pay for it. I like Yogi Berra's version of the Herb Stein quote, "That which cannot go on forever usually won't."
Stenholm co-chairs a budget reform task force that recommended a combination of spending cuts and tax hikes to keep the federal debt from ballooning as a share of the U.S. economy. The task force is careful to say spending cuts or tax hikes should be phased in slowly after 2011 so as not to make the recession worse. But some liberals worry that even talking about deficit-fighting measures at this point is premature.
The time to start reining the deficit back in is when the economy starts to recover and not one moment sooner.
Josh Bivens is an economist at the labor-backed Economic Policy Institute. He says in the current environment, fear of big deficits is misplaced. After all, interest rates are low, inflation's no threat, and there's little danger that government borrowing will crowd out private investment, which is still anemic. If anything, Bivens says, the government should be going deeper into debt in an effort to create more jobs.
Deficits are not always and everywhere bad. It's a tool. And sometimes the federal budget should go into bigger deficit to aid prosperity. Sometimes it should go into smaller deficit or even surplus. We're absolutely at a time right now where we need bigger deficits to aid that prosperity.
Here's the rub. The same polls that find voters concerned about the deficit show they're downright alarmed about unemployment. And tackling either one of those problems is likely to make the other one worse. Spending money on job creation adds to the deficit, while fighting the deficit with spending cuts or higher taxes could choke off the recovery. It's a political minefield for the president. But pollster Guerin says there is a path of escape.
The voters accept the premise that you have to deal with the deficit in a way that is consistent with growing the economy.
That means bigger deficits now, along with a promise of more budget discipline later. That's the path President Obama is likely to take in his State of the Union address. Here's White House Economic Advisor Christina Romer in an interview with CNN.
To the degree that we, of course, care deeply about the deficit, and you're right, in 2010, that is going to be something very much that the president is focusing on and talking about. It is important to understand we're also talking about actions taken right now, targeted actions to jumpstart job creation, and there is no conflict between those.
Over the weekend, Mr. Obama endorsed legislation that would set up a bipartisan budget commission to make recommendations on tax hikes and spending cuts later this year. One appeal of this approach is that it offers the promise of deficit reduction while postponing any hard decisions until the economy's on more solid ground, or at least until after the November election. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.